You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Break a Bat podcast, where baseball meets Broadway. An attempt to show that my two favorite mediums don't have to live in such separate worlds and maybe even break some stigmas. We're happy to have you with us. Now let's play ball. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Break a Bat. I'm your host, Al Malafronte, coming at you from Broadway with my guest host for the day, Connor Lester.
Thanks for having me, Al.
Pleasure to have you, Connor. Well, the MLB playoffs are upon us once again, and it's the 10-year anniversary of the 2009 Yankees, a season in which they won their most recent championship. Brian Hoke is the Yankees beat reporter for MLB.com and recently co-authored a book with Mark Feinsohn titled Mission 27, A New Boss, A New Ballpark, and One Last Ring for the Yankees Core Four. The book was released over the summer and chronicles everything you'd want to know about one of the most beloved Yankee teams of all time. Today, he's nice enough to call in and talk about all that and more. Please welcome to the stage, Brian Hoke. How are you, Brian?
I'm doing great. What an intro. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, that's how we do it on Broadway. We're extra theatrical around here, you know?
Beautiful. Yeah, no, it's a nice change of pace from what we usually get out of the ballpark. So this will be fun.
Absolutely. And, you know, I got to tell you, I've pretty much told everyone how much I really loved your book. 2009 was such a special season to me. And I know for you and Mark, you were both on the beat together that year. Can you give me a little backstory as to what the inspiration was, you know, as far as deciding to write about that particular Yankee team and doing it when you did?
Absolutely. Yeah. So Mark and I had both had our first books out, and mine was on the Baby Bombers and this whole new core of Aaron Judge and Gary Sanchez, Luis Severino, all these guys who were now part of this team that is going to go for a World Series championship. And Mark had another book that was out, and really we wanted to do another book, but it's difficult to do one by yourself. That's what we found. And so we were kind of brainstorming for something we could collaborate on, and we both kept coming back to 2009 because it was such a special year, as you mentioned. Obviously, they won the World Series, but it was a lot more than that, too, because you had the closing of the old Yankee Stadium, this grand historic venue that was being kind of boarded up and torn down, and you've got this new $1.6 billion cathedral rising across the street, and I think the move between ballparks is how we set the stage for this season. But the Yankees also went out and spent almost $500 million on star players like CeCe Sabathia, AJ Burnett, Mark Teixeira. And it was obviously a fun year to be around, an eventful year to be around the team. But I feel like for Yankee fans, the 2009 Yankees didn't get enough credit in the moment. First of all, people thought that they just bought a championship, which is not the case. I mean, they did get high-paid players, but a whole lot needs to go right, as we've seen in the years that followed. And I think that, you know, for Mark and I, being on the beat, you figured this Yankees team, it was an older team, but they were so good in 2009, you figured there'd be more to come. So you didn't really celebrate it as a one-and-done because you expected they'd be right back there in the postseason in 2010, 2011, 2012, and they'd probably get another World Series title. And it just didn't work out that way. And so when we talked to all the players and we tracked down almost everybody on that roster, they said, of course we thought that we were going to win more. And so they didn't enjoy it as much in the moment. So it's almost like now 10 years later, we're finally giving that team its due because the teams of the 90s were celebrated so much. That one almost was an outlier because they didn't repeat and get back to the top of the mountain. And as it turned out, it was the final time we'd ever see Derek Jeter hold the World Series trophy. Same with Mariano Rivera, who just went in the Hall of Fame. And so it was really a lot of fun. I keep telling everyone it was like going back to your high school or college reunion, you know, hanging out with the guys and telling old stories again. So hopefully that translated in the book.
Well, I certainly think it did. And, you know, one thing that you touched on, you know, was the expectation that the team is going to keep winning because of the high profile names that they brought in. That was very much the case also in the mid 2000s when you had A-Rod and you had Giambi, Sheffield, Matsui. there was an expectation that they were just going to keep winning. However, one thing that you touch on in the book, and Brian Cashman even acknowledges it, and he acknowledged it to CC Sabathia when he was signing him, was the fact that it was a bit of a broken clubhouse before 2009. When did you first notice the change in attitude and the change in dynamic in the Yankee locker room in 2009?
Almost immediately, because CC Sabathia was such a huge part of that. He was so inclusive with everybody on the team, you know. I say that before the CC era, in 2007 was my first year on the beat, but I remember being around that Yankee clubhouse a little earlier than that. It was a fractured, not a lot of fun room to be around. You know, and I'm thinking of guys like Tony Womack and Gary Sheffield and Kevin Brown and Randy Johnson. I mean, all great players, but it didn't click, and it wasn't a pleasant environment to be around. And even circa 07, 08, when the transition happened from Joe Torre to Joe Girardi, there was some of that still left over, I felt. It was completely eradicated when CC Sabathia showed up. You had also Nick Swisher was a huge personality, came in the room. And Swisher, you know, Mark Teixeira talked about, those guys felt that they were able to be themselves and kind of take care of business behind the scenes, because Swisher was happy to be on stage and have the red light on and be in front of the camera and clown around and do all that bro stuff. And the guys appreciated that because, A, they laughed at Swisher and they found it amusing, but B, it really took the heat off them. And Sabathia did the same thing. You know, he was inclusive with all the pitchers. He organized a lot of outings. The guys went to Orlando Magic games during spring training. They had barbecues. They had, you know, fishing excursions. The starting pitchers, the position players, they would all hang out. And so I think that is vitally important for a team. I don't think they all have to be 25 best friends and go out to dinner together every night, but it sure is nice if they do, and it's even nicer if they're winning. And that's the big thing about that team. They won 103 games, and you had a collection of really talented players who enjoyed being around each other, and that's what made it so much fun to kind of dig back into.
You know, you speak about talented players. There was nobody more talented than A-Rod, and A-Rod obviously was humbled that offseason, you know, after not only the steroid allegations, you know, that came against him, which he ended up acknowledging, and then, of course, his hip surgery. He didn't think he was going to play baseball again. He comes back, and he really became—he came back as a different man, and the team really seemed to rally around him. Was that the first time that you really saw that clubhouse rally around A-Rod? And he certainly put them on his back, you know, come the postseason, but give me your impressions on A-Rod.
Yeah, I think he changed the storyline that year. And obviously, I mean, there were so many ups and downs, and he would have more downs later after 2009. But that was the best year of his career because it's the only time that he was able to win a World Series. And I think that the storyline between him and Derek Jeter was never going to go away, and he was never going to win that one. You know, he was late to the party. He missed the first World Series title, so anytime you compare Derek and A-Rod, as everybody loved to do, and look, if you were a newspaper guy and you were hurting for a story, write Jeter and A-Rod. It'll wind up on the back page, you know. And yeah, it was a layup. And so I feel that was done to death, and it was kind of a tiresome storyline. And then, as you mentioned, that is the spring we find out that A-Rod is a steroid user, and he admits to his past use with the Texas Rangers. There would be more to come. Not that we knew that at the time, but and then he comes back. He has hip surgery, which he thinks is career threatening. He said the first thing he did was he Googled Bo Jackson hip surgery because he thought his career was over. He's wondering if he's going to be able to pick up his kids at some point again, let alone turn around on a 95 mile an hour fastball. And as it turns out, that's exactly what he did. His first game back in May in Baltimore, first at bat, first pitch, he hits a 3-run homer in the seats in left field, and he's off and running. The Yankees have A-Rod back, and I think that the real stain on his career to that point had been he was a playoff choker. Even though it's not completely accurate, there was enough times that he didn't come through in the big games, and once they got to that October, he was coming through all the time. So many big hits, so many home runs, and you know, it's funny, I ran into Alex about a month or two ago. He was doing a game for Sunday Night Baseball, and he was asking me about the book, and he said, "So how much of me did you use in it?" I said, "Alex, you were you're all over that book. You were such a huge part of the 2009 Yankees," and that made him laugh and smile. So I think that Alex, in addition to everybody else, really enjoyed kind of going back into that year and peeling back the onion for us, because I mean, it was a fantastic year for them. Of course you want to talk about the best year of your career.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I love how you mentioned, you know, the homer on the first pitch when he returned off the DL in Baltimore. One other thing in the book that you go pretty in depth on is that Atlanta series that's later that summer. I believe it was in June when, you know, the team was struggling. And Alex and Francesco Cervelli were instrumental in helping turn things around that series after Brian Cashman had a talk with the team. Do you consider that to be the true turning point for the 09 Yankees, or do you think it was getting over the hump in August when they started to have their way with the Red Sox after not beating them all season?
Yeah, for sure. And that's one thing to think about in that season, is that they did start the year 0-8 against Boston, which is remarkable, the fact that they were able to come back and reclaim they're standing in the division, because that was a problem to begin with. But I do remember vividly that series in Atlanta, because it did feel like a turning point at that time. And I think that it's not just Cashman flying down there, because if I remember correctly, it's not like they went out and scored 10 runs in the first inning. They were struggling. They were getting no hit at one point there in that game. And I remember Joe Girardi coming out of the dugout, and Brett Gardner got picked off first base. Brett is a young player at that time. Obviously, now he's the salty old veteran of the Yankees. But he gets picked off first base, and Girardi comes out of the dugout, and he told us that he was not going to leave that field without getting ejected. Like, it's one of those times where you figure you've got to do something to fire up your team, and Joe knew the timing was right there, and he was in the first base umpire, Bill Welke's face, and basically told him, "I'm not leaving here until you throw me out." And eventually Welke threw him out, and the Yankees rallied back. And so in hindsight, yeah, it was a huge turn of events there to go to Atlanta. And right before that series, the Yankees had played in Miami. A lot of guys stayed out a little bit too late. You know, they were having fun. You know, you don't get too many trips to Miami when you're a Yankee. And so that was kind of a turning point in that Cashman got the team together, didn't scream and holler and throw the buffet table, but basically, and we call it the principal in the book, because Mark Teixeira said it was kind of like getting called to the principal's office. And the principal doesn't yell and scream. He just tells you he's disappointed in you and that you've got to do better. And that's basically what Cashman told us he did. He's got this kind of peppy monotone that he speaks in, and basically told them, "You're better than this. This is not what I brought you here to do. We paid a lot of money for this team, so we expect results." And they went out and got them. So I think it was just a matter of time, whether it happened in Atlanta or later in the year. You had such a talented group there that it was going to mesh at some point. It just took a little time to kind of gel together.
How much of that do you attest to Jeter and A-Rod seemingly being able to coexist for the first time?
Yeah, I think that winning cures everything. And I don't think Derek was ever going to call Alex among his closest friends again. And Alex obviously knew that their relationship, at one point he said they don't have sleepovers six nights a week anymore. And you don't have to be. I think all they had to do was do their job. Derek was the shortstop, Alex was the third baseman. And, you know, get all the balls you can on the left side of the field, hit the crap out of the ball when you can. And they coexisted that way because they were pulling in the same direction, which was not always the case. I think that there was a lot of noise always around Alex. There still is. I think that there's always a lot of attention on what he does, and it's all magnified. And Derek, I think, did not like that. Derek came from a school where you were supposed to show up the first day of spring training, focus on winning the World Series, and not stop until you achieve that goal. And, you know, having fun along the way, you know, what was fun, winning was fun. And then Alex did a lot of kind of goofy things away from the field, and just a totally different personality. And I think in that year, they both had terrific seasons. They were on a terrific team that could go all the way. And like I said, they were pulling in the same direction that year. And, you know, we have a scene later in the book after they beat the Twins in the first round, and they've got this kind of piano bar team party at the hotel in Minneapolis. And Derek and Alex and Minka Kelly and Kate Hudson, they're all sitting at the table together, kind of laughing, having a couple cocktails, and you know, just really kind of having this moment. I believe Michael Kay told us about that, and it was kind of like, oh wow, you know, the team is really together. And I think that that speaks volumes when you have guys who like spending time around each other and are able to coexist that way.
Yeah, and they both certainly had monster postseasons, as did CeCe Sabathia. Hideki Matsui obviously had that amazing World Series performance, as did Johnny Damon. One thing I've always been curious about, did you notice a change in the clubhouse after 2009 once Matsui and Damon had left? And do you attest that at all to, you know, part of why they didn't win after?
You know, we were talking to Johnny Damon for this book, and I asked Johnny, I said, why do you think the team didn't repeat after that? And he said, well, that's easy. They didn't bring back me and Matsui. And, you know, nobody's a bigger fan of himself than Johnny Damon. Love him. I mean, he's the best.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorites.
But yeah, absolutely. And I think that there was a kind of a change there, I understand why they did what they did. Look, Johnny Damon wanted a multi-year deal. It turned out that he would only get 1 year from the Tigers, but he was looking for 3 or 4 years. And Hideki Matsui limped through that postseason. He didn't know if he had much left in him. Obviously, had a monster postseason and 6 RBIs in the clinching game. But it was probably the right business decision, looking at it, to say, all right, it's time to move on and go to other guys. But they didn't pick the right guys. That's the problem. You know, they went to Nick Johnson, and Curtis Granderson came in and was a solid player, but there was something missing there too. And I think that, they were still a postseason team, but it was not quite the same juggernaut feel of 2009. And I think that really just shows you how hard it is to repeat. That's why we don't see teams winning back-to-back-to-back World Series very frequently. I think it's just, it's hard to have everything go right 2 years in a row. Look at the Red Sox. I mean, they're a perfect example. Last year, the Red Sox, unstoppable team, 108 wins in the regular season. The Yankees spent the entire year looking up at them. And you had largely the same group come back this year, but for whatever reason, it just didn't click. And I think that sometimes that magic, I hate to say that because you really can't quantify what that magic is, but you know it when you're around it. You definitely felt it in 2009. And by 10, 11, 12, it wasn't quite there. You knew that the Yankees had a good team, and if things broke right for them, they could go deep into the postseason. But playoffs are a crapshoot. You know, the best teams get in, and it's the hottest team at the end that is able to run the table and get those 11 wins to win a World Series. And, you know, we'll see what happens here in 2019. I think that this team has every capability of catching fire and getting hot at the right time.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, I heard your old Derek Jeter adage, the best team makes it, the hottest team wins. One last question regarding 2009 specifically. Had they won in 10, 11, or 12, do you think Joe Girardi's still managing the team this year?
Ooh, that is a good question. If they had won back-to-back-to-back World Series, but then everything else continued the way it was.
Or even if had they won just one more.
Yeah. You know, I think that the thing I wonder about is Hal Steinbrenner and Brian Cashman have always said that they had made up their minds before 2017 that Girardi was not coming back, but before the postseason. They had made up their minds. And that team was one win away from going to the World Series. If they went down to Houston, won that Game 7, and then went to Los Angeles and beat the Dodgers, let's say they sweep the Dodgers, are you going to tell me they're really not going to bring Joe Girardi back for after the parade. I'm not so sure about that. That really would have tested what they think. And obviously they've made a good call with Aaron Boone. He's won 100 games back-to-back years and has had control of that team. But I find it very difficult to believe that if Girardi was coming off a World Series championship in 2017, that he wouldn't have been back for 18. It's not unprecedented, but I feel like there would have been such public outcry to bring back Girardi. And I think that he would have come back. I know they've said otherwise, but that's what I believe. And Joe Girardi's a great manager. If I had a franchise, I'd want Joe Girardi managing that team. And it's funny, you know, the MLB Network had Girardi on yesterday working the desk when the Yankees clinched the division, and they went live to Aaron Boone on the field at Yankee Stadium, and Joe Girardi's asking Aaron Boone questions, and I'm just thinking, this is kind of awkward. Yeah. But
we were watching that.
Joe, I think, will get another opportunity to manage. I think that he's obviously had offers, and I think you'll see him in a dugout again someday.
All right, Brian, shifting gears a little bit, let's talk about the current team since we are in 2019. With the Domingo Germán situation, can you tell us anything that you've heard regarding that? And how do you think this changes the Yankees pitching staff moving up into the postseason?
I think it changes it quite a bit, you know, because Boone and Brian Cashman had been thinking about the possibility of using Germán as kind of this super reliever that they could bring in tandem, you know, starters. They could just say you have like a Jay Happ go three innings, and then you go to Germán for the next three innings, and all of a sudden it's the top of the seventh inning and you've probably got a lead. And I think they're not going to be able to do that now. I think they're going to have to go more traditional with their starting pitching. So it really is a big blow to take that arm out of there. And I don't want to downplay the importance and significance of what's going on. I mean, that is hugely important. Obviously, there is no question in my mind that he shouldn't be pitching right now. I think that you just wonder why a guy would do a thing like that. And all the allegations, all the information is not out there yet, but clearly something happened to warrant this investigation. And what I've heard, it's not pretty. So it's disappointing news. It's surprising to me. I wouldn't have expected Domingo Germán would be that kind of guy and we'd be having this kind of conversation, but in a baseball sense, the Yankees have had all sorts of injuries and taken a lot of hits all year long. They've had so many guys go down and hurt. This is just one more thing they're going to have to overcome if they want to get where they want to be.
Assuming, and this is asking a lot given the way that the season has gone, how do you see the playoff rotation shaking out?
Yeah, I think that they're giving us some breadcrumbs here to hint how they're going to line it up. I think that they could go James Paxton in game one. They could go Masahiro Tanaka game two. I could definitely see that happening. Then you have Luis Severino three, and that would give you the option, I believe, if the schedule works out the way I'm thinking of it. You could go to Jay Happ for a game four, or you could go back to Paxton perhaps. And that's one thing that you get the advantage of during the postseason is you get those off days, those travel days built in. The good news is for the Yankees, they'll have home field advantage when they play in the division series. It's not clear if they will in the ALCS. They would probably have to play game six and seven on the road if they're playing the Astros. So that's something else they'll have to contend with. But I think those are going to be your starting pitchers. And like I said, you'll have a more traditional rotation is what I expect to see as a result of the Germán injury. I just think you're not going to have the flexibility, but they've got a great bullpen. So you in the postseason, you don't need your starters to go six, seven, eight innings unless you're Justin Verlander and the Astros. I think that you're content to get four plus innings. If you get the ball through five, the Yankees have a great bullpen. And I believe the statistic is they're 42-0 when they're big four relievers at the back end pitch.
Wow.
And that, yeah, 42-0 when they get all those guys in the same game. And so it clearly has worked. And I'm talking about Tommy Canley and Zach Britton and Adam Ottavino and Aroldis Chapman. And so if they can get the ball to those guys to hand it off, I do like their chances of locking down games and getting the win.
And on the topic of the ALDS, who do you see as the sort of best case matchup scenario for the Yankees?
I think the most likely outcome is going to be the Twins. I'm not sure if that is best case. The Yankees did have a winning record against Minnesota this season. I tell you what, you've got two teams that can slug the heck out of the ball. And I think that if you put those teams in Yankee Stadium, Target Field, they're going to make it look small. And there was that hugely entertaining series where the Yankees went to Minnesota in July. Aaron Hicks made a fantastic catch, you know, probably the catch of the year, to save this crazy 14-12 game. I think that's what you're going to see. And we're talking all about the pitching. I think that it's not going to matter a whole lot when you put those two teams head-to-head in the postseason, because they're both going to slug. And I think that you're going to see some pinball arena baseball scores, and that's ALDS. And it's going to be the team that hits the ball over the wall the most that comes away standing at the end of it. These two teams obviously have hit more home runs than any other teams in Major League history, breaking the Yankees' record from last year. So I think my scorecard, I'm going to need a little extra ink for that series if that's the way it goes.
Yeah, I could totally see records. That. Yeah, for sure. Now, Brian, we thought it would be a fun way to wrap our time with you for a little segment that we call Fastball Derby. We would ask you a question, and you'll tell us the first thing that comes to your head. How does that sound?
Oh, this could be dangerous, but yeah, let's go for it.
All right. Connor, why don't you start, buddy?
All right, Brian. In a hypothetical three-way series, who wins the 99, 09, or 2019 New York Yankees?
Ooh, I'm going to go 09. I think that team can slug, and yeah, I'm going to go 09. They've got the three starting pitchers, and the Yankees in 09 only used three guys. So the 99 Yankees, it's funny. Nobody really gives that team a whole lot of credit, because 98 was great, and then 2000 they beat the Mets, and it's almost like the forgotten team of that dynasty. But yeah, I'll go 09, and since the story is incomplete here in 19, we don't know how that's going to wind up.
Brian, I just want to mention, 99 was the first season that I watched baseball, and people don't give that team enough credit. They went 11-1 that postseason, so I personally look back on them very fondly, and I hope there's a nice segment of Yankee fans that do as well.
Yeah, for sure. Now I kind of want to do that in like a computer league, and let's get those two teams together and see how they wind up in a best of seven.
I'm in. Let's do it. All right. Most theatrical Yankee you ever covered?
Most theatrical. I mean, the first thing that pops in my mind is Nick Swisher. I mean, like I said, the camera was always on, and Nick, you know, I think he was actually on Broadway. I think he was in Rock of Ages once. I think he did a cameo in that. So yeah, Swish is my answer for that. I think you stick him out on the stage tonight on Broadway, he'll put on a good show for you.
And he is married to an actress, so his skills have probably gotten even better. There you go.
That's right. Joanna Garcia Swisher. Yep.
That's right.
All right. Best game you've ever covered. Maybe regular season since most memorable regular season since
memorable regular season game. The first thing that pops in my mind is Derek Jeter's final game. There was so much build up to how that was going to go. How could he author the perfect ending? And then I remember Dave Robertson blew the save, and it was like, oh my God, is he going to go out this? They're going to lose in Derek Jeter's final game. And of course, he has the inside-out single to right field, knocks in the winning run, and I remember turning to the guy sitting next to me in the press box, we're watching this happen, and I say, how? How does he always have the perfect ending? And I just, in my mind's eye, I see him leaping around first base, kind of caught in midair, hands, his fist in the air, just kind of hovering there, the great photograph, and Derek Jeter's final Yankee Stadium at bat ended with a walk-off single, because of course it did.
It was, unreal.
Who was more difficult to interview during their prime, Jeter or A-Rod?
A-Rod. Obviously, like I said, Alex was great to us for the book, but Derek was always available. He might not give you a whole lot. It was always vanilla and very guarded, but he was there. He was there every single day, and if you needed a quote from Derek Jeter just to, on whatever the topic of the day was, you'd get it. Alex was more difficult to track down. It was kind of, a lot of times you'd be walking in the hallway and Alex would be coming toward you and there'd be nobody else around, and Alex would have his eyes pinned to the ceiling, and his lip pursed and just kind of whistling to himself. And it's like, dude, I know you see me, you know, but okay, fine. And that was just, you know, I think, you know, as I've talked to him more since he's retired, I think he had to build those walls around himself. He felt like he needed to insulate himself and kind of block out some of the noise because there was so much going on around him all the time. And I guess I've kind of softened a little bit and become more sympathetic, but it was kind of a pain and during his career. And a lot of that was always, especially once the steroid stuff started happening and he was suing Major League Baseball and there was all sorts of litigation. And it was like covering two things at once. You had to cover Alex and then you had to cover the Yankee game. And so it was great because it made for great copy and people cared about it, obviously, but I think it was definitely difficult and challenging to have to try and keep up with all of that.
All right. Give us a name of maybe an unheralded prospect, someone that's in the minors right now that you think we should keep an eye out for.
Ooh, wow. That's a good one. There's a few guys, but I think the one guy who has really impressed me, and I know he didn't have a great year this year, Esteban Florial has been in spring training with the Yankees the last couple of years. He's a center fielder, five-tool kind of guy. He can run, he can throw, he can hit for power. His speed is off the charts. Great defense in center field, and he got hurt this year in spring training, broke his wrist, crashing into the center field wall. But this kid, I think, is going places. I think that you're going to be seeing him at Yankee Stadium at some point in the future. He really did impress me this year. They've got a few other prospects up and down, but yeah, the first name that comes to my mind is Florial, and he's so bright and sharp and just really impressed me being around. He's so young. I think he's 21 going on 22, so he's got time to develop, but I think that he's a guy that I'm still keeping an eye on, and I want to see how the rest of that story plays out.
Favorite city or ballpark to travel to on the beat?
Wow. Favorite city might be San Francisco. You know, the Yankees played there and we got to play against the Giants this year. And that's such a great scene. It's less great when you have to go across the Bay Bridge and go play in Oakland against the A's. But, yeah, I think that San Francisco might be my favorite city to go to. Favorite ballpark is actually Target Field in Minnesota. I think that field, they did everything right. It's perfect. It's modern. It's old school at the same time. You know, if we're going to pick a park that is not Yankee Stadium, I'm going to go Minnesota. And, you know, it was cool to go to Dodger Stadium this year, but I'm glad we don't have to do that every year. I think that, you know, it's kind of a time capsule that belongs in that Wrigley Field, Fenway Park kind of grouping, and just in terms of it's cool to sit there and think about what it was like in 1962, but then you realize you can't get out of your chair and you can't move around and everything is kind of antiquated. So yeah, no, I'm going to go Target Field. I think honorable mention Safeco Field or T-Mobile Park, what they call it now in Seattle, but favorite city, San Fran.
Awesome.
Are the balls juiced and will the balls be juiced in 2020?
They are absolutely juiced and I hope not, but yeah, maybe. Same. Yeah. I mean, obviously I think everybody knows something is up and I noticed it this year and the Yankees came north from spring training and they were taking batting practice and it was one of those freezing cold 38 degree afternoons and the ball was just flying to the back of the bleachers. And I was thinking, it's almost like they're hitting with golf balls. And I'm thinking something is not right here. You know, I've just watched spring training for 7-8 weeks in Florida and the ball was not flying like that. And now you get up to Yankee Stadium, it's freezing cold. And, you know, they're taking off like Titleist from home plate. It was weird. And, it's continued to be weird. I said, I wonder what it's going to be like when the summer months come and it warms up and the weather's good. And I think you've seen the answer to that. So hopefully they can, look, offense is great. People like to see home runs. I have no problem with that. But hopefully you can tone it down just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I heard when Bob Costas was doing the game this summer, I think he made a really great point when he said the home run should be an exclamation point, not commonplace. And I think that really summed it up well.
Yeah, I like that. I like that and I agree with that. And look, I'm not saying I want to see every game 2-1 and guys go back to hitting soft singles through the middle. I mean, I want to see the ball fly and that's fun, but I do understand why the pitchers are kind of scratching their heads and saying, hey, you know, it's my job to get people out, and this is not easy. So I think if we can tip it back a little bit in the pitcher's favor, that would be good for everybody.
Now, Brian, our last two questions are going to be in the spirit of the other genre of our podcast, which is Broadway. I know that, you know, you're a pretty fair weather Broadway fan, but you enjoy a good show. saw Waitress recently.
I did.
What'd you think of it, first of all?
It was great. No, I enjoyed it. My wife wanted to see it. And I always enjoy going out to Broadway shows. And we used to live on the Upper West Side, so we take advantage of it quite a bit and head down. I wouldn't say I'm a diehard Broadway fan, but I enjoy it. And it definitely, I say that is the perfect way to spend a night out in New York City. You get a good dinner and go see a show, and even if the show's not that great, you've had a full evening, and now we've got kids and we're out in Jersey, so we don't get in quite as much as we used to do, but still love getting in there, especially if we can find a babysitter.
Yeah. Well, if you ever need advice on which shows to see, we're more than happy to help you with that. Now, that being said, do you have a favorite show tune?
Favorite show tune? Oh, man, I'm not the best at this. I'm really not. But the first thing that just came to my mind was Good Morning Baltimore from Hairspray.
And, oh, that's a great one.
It's probably because I hear it all the time when we go play the Orioles. But
they play that at Camden Yards?
I always like that.
That's great.
I always like that. Yeah, I always like that one. That one, that's my answer.
That's awesome. And then lastly, if you want, you could give us three. If you want to rank your top three Broadway musicals, or you could just give us your favorite.
Wow. Top three. This is tough, you guys.
And we saved the hardest one for last. It's like Chapman coming in the ninth inning. You know, all of a sudden, everyone's throwing 98, 99. Then you see 103.
I know. And I can't catch up to it. Man, this is not my forte. But I'd say Waitress was up there. You know, I saw Rock of Ages three times. I really enjoyed that one. That was right in my wheelhouse. And enjoyed that, and I'm trying to think, man. I think I'm gonna have to take a pass on this one, guys. I want to give you a good answer, but I've spent too much time at the ballpark. I think
that's more than fair, Brian. Listen, it was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for coming on.
You got it. Thanks, guys, for having me, and I'll work on getting that list to you.
I appreciate it. That sounds great. Well, that'll close out the ball game here on Break a Bat. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Break a Bat. This is produced by the fine folks at the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit and subscribe at bpn.fm/breakabat. You can find me online at break_a_bat_podcast. And you can also find the Broadway Podcast Network on Instagram at Broadway Podcast Network. It's been so great having you here with us today. And we'll see you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.